You've got to kind of have that desire to say, hey, I want to invest in something outside of just the typical stocks, bonds, mutual funds. How do I do that in real estate? And that's definitely an education process because it is hard for people to kind of wrap their head around something outside those traditional investments.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I am your host, Justin Dixon. And today we've got Todd Sulzinger on the podcast. He is the founder and CEO of Blue Elm Investments, a boutique private equity real estate investment firm based in San Francisco, California. Todd is a W-2 worker. He works in finance, but he started this business a few years ago on the side, really with single family houses. And then he moved up market into syndication for mobile home parks. So we dig into the different deals that he's done in the mobile home parks. We actually unpack a little bit around seller financing, which is a super fascinating way to work with the seller of a property to actually carry the note, effectively becoming the bank. So we dig into that a little bit. And then we talk about some of the RV parks that he's invested in recently as well. So super fascinating conversation. So let's get Todd on the pod. Todd, man, thanks for being on the pod. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Justin. It's great to be here.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to chat and love to learn more about your story. So let's kick things off. Maybe give the audience a little bit of an intro of you and Blue Elm and all that fun stuff. And then we'll dig into some stuff.
Sounds good. Yeah. Todd Sulzinger, based here in Redwood City, California, within Silicon Valley, about halfway between San Jose and San Francisco. I was born and raised in San Jose, went to San Jose State University, got a degree in finance there. And from there, started off working for a bunch of high tech companies in Silicon Valley. And probably about 10 years ago or so, I kind of got the bug to start investing in real estate and went down the path like a lot of people do, buying single family homes. And decided from that standpoint, I wanted to try my hand at kind of building a business around combining my finance background with my passion for real estate and started Blue Elm Investments to start letting investors invest passively in real estate.
Got it. So growing up in the San Francisco, Silicon Valley area, especially as a young adult and career and all of that, how did you kind of go from a W-2 job and working in these high-tech businesses to then being like, or the openness to alternative investing, if you will?
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of a couple things. One was I started listening to podcasts. I found the Real Estate Guys radio show pretty early on.
Yeah,
I was listening to them quite a bit. And I had a neighbor, the first house I bought in San Jose, guy lived a couple doors down from me, an older gentleman, mild mannered, kind of this millionaire next door kind of guy, drove a beat up car. But the more I got to know him, he'd start saying things like, oh, yeah, I've got to go see this rental property down the street. Oh, yeah, I've got to go visit this commercial building. I've got to go do this. And so the more I got to know him, I thought, this guy has real estate all over the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And it just really got me interested in thinking like, wow, like how did this guy do that? I'm not sure if he had a degree, but it wasn't like he had to work inside a tech company climbing the corporate ladder to build this big portfolio. So that was one of the things that really got me intrigued about thinking, yeah, is there some way I can do this and start investing?
Did your neighbor give you kind of any tips, tricks, or help you in that kind of initial journey? Or was it more or less like, he's doing something I should be thinking about doing, and you kind of just started peeling back the onion on your own?
That was really it. Yeah. The more I got talking to him, even to the point where when we ended up moving from that house, he said, like, how much are you selling that for? Maybe I'll buy it. And I'm thinking, this guy just looks at every piece of real estate around him. Like, how can I make money? Or how could I potentially buy this? And so it was more his, he was more of an inspiration for me to get into the business.
Yeah. And so what's your situation right now? Are you still W-2? Like, walk me through kind of where you are in that journey.
Sure. Yeah. Actually, I just recently started a new W-2 position. In between my last one and this current role I just started, I had done some consulting roles still in finance. And then for a time, I was doing some consulting for a mobile home park consulting company who was actually my initial property manager. So after I got into the mobile home park business in my first couple syndications, the president of that company asked if I wanted to kind of join his team. And their company, they kind of do a combination of property management, but also help people almost in a brokerage type fashion buy and sell mobile home parks. So I did that for a couple of years working with them as well.
Got it. Interesting. Well, I definitely want to unpack the mobile home park part. But before we do that, I'm curious about a lot of people that I talk to and meet. They typically start their investing journey in things they know. And typically it starts with single family. So what was that first investment like? Maybe let's unpack that a little bit, because I think that's important for people that are listening, that are interested in, maybe they haven't done or dipped their toe into the real estate world and they want to maybe start with something kind of quote unquote easy. And single family tends to be that kind of path of least resistance to real estate investing.
Yeah, I agree. And that's how I thought I would be the best way for me to get started as well. The hard part about living in a place like Silicon Valley is the real estate's expensive and California is a very tenant friendly state. So a house I was living in, I did rent out for a time before I moved back into it. So I got a little taste of being a landlord, but it was actually through the real estate guys, Robert Helms and Russell Gray. I'd been listening to their radio show podcast for quite a few years. And then after listening to it for a couple of years, I finally found out that they didn't live too far from where I did. They both used to live in the Bay Area and they would just host local smaller meetups. So 20, 30 person meetups pretty close to where I lived. In one of their meetings, they had a guy who was doing turnkey properties in Dallas. And that idea just sounded crazy to me, that you would buy a rental property that's thousands of miles from where you live. But I took a field trip, one of those bus tour type things where you drive through neighborhoods and meet brokers and insurance agents. And through that process, ended up buying a few homes. First off, from a guy who was built to rent before built to rent was called that, but he was building properties in a neighborhood specifically for investors and had reasonable prices, had a good warranty with them. Financing was great. So I took the plunge and bought a few houses in Dallas.
And so how did that work? Like, I've heard of some people doing turnkey and it is kind of the easy button, right? For some people, because they don't have to worry about renovations and finding tenants and all stuff. So how did it work? Like, what was your involvement and what did you get when you kind of signed the deal?
Yeah. So they did not put a tenant in place for me like some turnkey providers do, but they did have property management in place ready to take over. One of the key things about that kind of made this attractive was this person had bought this parcel of land that was going to be a full, like a new home development for residents in the financial crash of 2008. And so because he was able to get those at such a good price, he was able to offer good financing terms. Mm-hmm. So I put 20% down, just traditional financing through a bank, and then he kind of refunded and took a 15% second. So these were $130,000, $140,000 homes at the time that I only had to put 5% net down.
Got it.
So cash flow wasn't great, just kind of with that 95% financing, but it allowed me to buy two or three homes pretty quickly versus maybe just one at a time, 6 months or a year.
When did you get into the single family? How long ago was that?
That was the end of 2013.
Got it. And how have they performed? Do you still own them? Did you sell them? Like, what's the kind of story with those?
Yeah, I actually ended up selling those properties partly to fund my syndication business and to start investing in some of my own deals. But I think overall, it was a great experience. The Dallas market in terms of price appreciation, which was kind of unusual. That was kind of the good things about Dallas historically, is that it didn't have a lot of highs and lows, just a good, steady, consistent market. Over the last 4 or 5 years, that story's changed and there's been a lot of price appreciation. But finding tenants when there was turnover was relatively easy. I did have kind of one bad situation where we had a tenant that turned one of my rental properties into her own strip club.
Wow.
So once we evicted her, we actually found like the entire bedroom painted black and like a stripper's pole built in. So sometimes it's passive and really easy. Other times you got weird stuff that happens.
Yeah, that's a first on the podcast and first that I've ever heard of a tenant turning a unit into a strip club. So
we could not believe it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that walkthrough once they moved out or during the tenant's time there was a bit unique.
Yeah, no doubt. Unbelievable. I can show you pictures sometime.
That's fair enough. So I want to kind of transition away from the single family a little bit, because it sounds like you're more into the syndication world and doing some other unique investments with mobile home parks and RV parks. But before we get into that, I want to take a quick sponsor break. So we'll be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
We are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. We've got Todd on the podcast today. And before we went to break, we kind of were talking a little bit about your journey into single family investing, and you kind of started with the turnkey model for investors. It's a little bit of an easy button. Typically, they already have a deal house that they purchased, that they renovated. Sometimes they have tenants in them, other times they don't. So all you really have to do is just buy the asset, frankly. And so it sounds like you had some unique experiences, mostly good in that. And then when did you kind of realize, okay, I want to go bigger. I want to do this thing called syndication. Walk me through that journey, because that's, again, another mindset shift to go upmarket into some bigger deals.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mentioned I had been listening to the Real Estate Guys radio show for quite a few years, and they do syndication training. So I thought I should go check out one of these events, right? Because, yeah, you know, I kind of really interested in this real estate. I think a lot of other people I talk to are, but they don't know how to get into it. And again, because California can be so expensive, it just seemed like it might not be achievable. So I went to one of their syndication events back in 2015. And after that, kind of like life got in the way, things got busy, and I didn't do anything about it, but I was continuing to educate myself. Yeah, I went back to a similar event in 2018 and thought, hey, if I'm really going to do this, I really got to take some action now. So it was kind of during that time, I thought, okay, I'm going to start this company and really start to research asset classes, markets, and try to figure out how I can get in this business. It was actually good during that time, having a W-2 where I was in an office all the time, talking to people, telling people what I was doing. And I got some interesting feedback from people like, oh yeah, you know, I'd love to invest in real estate, but I don't know how. Is it hard? Do I have to deal with tenants? All those kind of things that syndicator can help do, and kind of started me on that path thinking, hey, maybe I can create a business out of this.
And what part of syndication did you start with, right? There's a lot of different roles or jobs, if you will, in a syndication, right? You've got to have people that are finding the deals. You've got to have people that are bringing investors to those deals, putting together the actual financing for it. The list kind of continues. So As you think about a general syndication, where did you fall, or where did you kind of start that journey?
Well, it's something I can't necessarily recommend, but I did all of them. I was the sole GP on the first two syndications I put together. Okay. And it actually started, I was working with a guy who was also interested in real estate. He'd done some other alternative investing, and he and I were going to buy something together. We decided to go the mobile park route. Yep. And he was going to bring in some of his investor group, and I was going to kind of work more on finding the deals and due diligence. Partway through the due diligence process of the first parks that I bought in Georgia, some of his investors fell out, and they were not going to be able to kind of contribute to this project. So I either had to decide at that time just to kind of give up and walk away from it, or plow through. So he was able to come in as a kind of a larger LP investor, but I just had to kind of figure out the rest of the process, try to find the rest of investors to fill out the deal, and did so, and ended up closing on it. So,
wow.
Yeah, so I kind of did the whole thing.
Right. So walk me through that deal. So first of all, mobile home parks. So why mobile home parks? We'll start there, and then I've got a couple of other kind of questions around that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, when I first wanted to start a syndication business, I was looking at a lot of different asset classes, apartments, mobile home parks, storage, mortgage notes, a lot of different things. And I'd been listening to a few different podcasts, Kevin Bupp, Jefferson Lilly, some of these guys. And I thought it was a really interesting niche. I think there's a huge need for affordable housing across the U.S.
Yeah.
There's hardly any new parks being built in any particular year. A lot of times they're being redeveloped.
Yep.
There was a little bit less competition. I know when I was starting to look at apartments, even smaller apartments or something, sometimes without multiple bids, best and final offers, hard money deposits that were deposits that would go hard instantly. The mobile home park space was competitive, but it was less frenzied than apartments were. And also there's sometimes the possibility to get seller financing, which kind of made it interesting as well. So yeah, so a few things made me think, okay, I can maybe getting in to start in mobile home parks versus apartments would be a good way to go.
And what are the returns typically, or how did you structure the syndication? Like, what were you kind of projecting to investors about, like, hey, this deal is going to be performing X? Like, was it a cash flow play? Like, what's the selling point on a mobile home park investment as an LP, I guess, or as a limited partner?
Sure. Yeah, you know, mobile home parks are really different. They're kind of all across the board. There's kind of maybe more often a bigger value add component. And that was the case with these parks that I bought in Georgia. Some of the things that were kind of oddball about this park, which is not uncommon in the mobile home park business, is that the owner of the parks was only accepting cash. So he would go to the park a couple times a week.
From the tenants. Got it.
From the tenants. Yeah, right. So he hadn't raised rents in 10 or 12 years and not sure exactly what he was doing, but there was a likelihood that he wasn't reporting all the cash and maybe given certain tenants discounts if they just wouldn't complain about maintenance repairs or if they did some work on the property for him. So yeah, it was, and again, a park like this too, it was about 60% occupied.
Okay.
And it's probably less common that you'd see in this case, a 71 space mobile home park, that it would be to have that occupancy compared to that size apartment.
Yeah.
Usually a property that big is more professionally run and might not have that low occupancy. So for that first deal, I was offering investors a 9% preferred return. And our targets over the projected 5-year hold were around 18 to 19%.
Mm.
But there was a value add component to as well, because we had to fill in some vacant lots, try to get rents closer to market. That went through our business plan.
And you said it was 71 spots?
The 71 pads was actually between two parks about a mile and a half from each other.
Got it.
In this town.
And were these, I did a little bit of research on mobile home parks a few years ago, because everybody and their brother was kind of starting to talk about mobile home parks. And yeah. I was like, oh, cool, maybe I should think about that. And so I started asking people that were doing it. And they're like, you want to make sure you find one that doesn't have a lot of property owned units. Mm-hmm. So you really just want to own the dirt and the pads. You don't want to actually own the physical mobile home, because then you always have to take care of it and all that fun stuff. Is that kind of how you thought about it? Was more around make sure either try to own as little of the actual physical unit as you possibly could and make sure you just only own the dirt, so to speak?
I kind of went in the opposite direction. And I don't think there's any one right way to do it. In situations where the tenants all own their homes and you're just renting out the pad for them. Yeah, that's absolutely the lowest maintenance. You just got to take care of infrastructure, landscaping, and that. Those parks can be hard to find because those are the ones everybody wants because they're easy.
Yeah.
The property management company that I worked with, most of the parks that they were managing, they probably managed 50, 60 parks across the country. They lean towards kind of specializing in park-owned home models. But yeah, and again, there's no right or wrong, but like in this park in Georgia, for example, the lot rents for the people that own their homes in the park, we did have some people own their homes, were between, say, $150 and $225 a month.
Yep.
And for those same lots where we would own the home, we were charging between, say, $500 and $800, including the lot rent. So I was like, am I going to get $200 a month or $800 a month? Okay, that's a $600 spread. Probably not going to cost $600 a month to maintain the house and deal with turnover. So if they're run well, you can make more money in the park-owned home model, but there's a lot more hair on those deals. They're harder to manage. There is higher turnover. So again, it's kind of no right or wrong. It just kind of depends what kind of park you want to run.
Yeah, it probably almost operates more like apartment complex if you own the units, because obviously you probably need more of an on-site management presence, assuming you have a big enough property, right? Because then you need people there that can, because you're going to have turnover, you're going to have leasing, you're going to have renovations and maintenance and all that fun stuff. So
exactly. And that's part of the challenge for sure, is finding a great on-site manager and ideally an on-site maintenance guy, if not somebody that's close that can take care of tenant issues as they come up.
Got it. So it sounds like you bought, was that first one purchased in 2018 when you kind of re-engaged?
It was 2019 is when I found it and closed on it. So.
And then where are you at right now with the mobile home park? And I know you've done some RV stuff, so I want to learn about that too. But where are you at portfolio-wise on the mobile home side?
Yeah, so I bought the ones in Georgia in 2019, bought another one in Tennessee in 2020, sold both of those. And I'm still in one in Arkansas. I did a joint venture for one in Arkansas, found a great park in this town called Batesville in northeastern Arkansas. Kind of the way we were going to have to fund the park's renovation, typically in a syndication, you'll want to raise all the money up front and kind of start the CapEx right away and put that money to use to start generating income. Otherwise, the investor's money is just kind of sitting in the bank, not doing anything.
Right. Yeah.
This park was going to take a more phased approach in terms of when we were going to need investment in the park. So it kind of made more sense for me to partner up with somebody. So I have one other joint venture partner in it. And that's kind of the way the deals happened. We put in kind of our initial money for the down payment, a few renovations. But as we've needed to rehab vacant homes over time, we've had to slowly had more money. So it's easier in a joint venture situation to do that with one other partner versus going out to 10 or 15 investors making capital calls once a year.
You're right. Right. And with these mobile home parks, are you able to add additional pads? Like, is that another value add option? I don't know how logistical that is, because obviously there's probably infrastructure that needs to be baked in, but just curious if that's something that you guys have done.
I haven't done that to this park, but there is space to do it. It's a 50 space park on about 15 acres, and there's probably seven or eight spaces. So in that situation, adding an electrical wouldn't be too difficult in terms of the poles. We'd have to put pedestals at each of the sites and add new septic tanks for those pads. But I think once we get all of the existing, all the vacant homes rehabbed and rented, then that would be either next step for us or maybe a potential kind of meat on the bone for another buyer would be to add additional spaces. So as long as the city or county says it's okay, then if you've got vacant spaces and there's demand for it, that's a great value add.
Yeah. And when you bring in or buy a place that has like vacant pads, like what type of homes do you put on there? Are you going to a manufactured home provider and putting a home on there? Or are you trying to find people that obviously have a mobile home that want to move it? How do you kind of fill a vacant pad?
Yeah. Well, like in the park we had in Georgia had some vacant pads. We ended up actually buying some refurbished used homes. So the same way there's like turnkey single family home providers, there are some people that have turnkey used mobile homes. So we bought some, I think they were late 90s or early 2000s, three bedroom, two bath homes. We bought them for probably higher than this now, but we bought those for like the low 20,000s.
Wow.
So those are ones that we purchased to rent. Here we're going to go with a new home route, either to sell to a potential tenant or to rent out. Those are usually financed. So you can get a dealer's license, work with a manufacturer, and they usually have their own financing programs if you wanted to bring newer homes into a park.
Yeah. And what are some of the, I guess, from your standpoint, because it sounds like you did your research on a few different syndication asset routes. What do you feel is a benefit for somebody that wants to passively invest, right? Because there's people on that are listening to this that are like, I don't want to do what you're doing and find these deals and have to put the deal together. I have a W-2 or I own a business and I make a lot of money and I just want to put that to work for me as opposed to putting it in a 401k or the stock market. So how do you kind of share that to an investor that's like, hey, this is a different route and here's why we like it, other than obviously the pref return and all that fun stuff. Mm-hmm. Like there's a level of security that people want when they invest in things, and especially when they're investing in something that maybe they haven't invested in before.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. I have investors that have kind of gone both sides. There's people that are tired landlords. They're like, ugh, I'm done with that. I'm going to start investing more passively. And then there's other people that are like, you know, I really like to have that control. I want to own my own properties directly. So you've got to kind of have that desire to say, hey, I want to invest in something outside of just the typical stocks, bonds, mutual funds. How do I do that in real estate? That's definitely an education process, because it is hard for people to kind of wrap their head around something outside those traditional investments. So it's a conversation I often have with my investors when they're trying to, again, wrap their heads around, like, how's this work? Okay, you're going to create an LLC. It's going to own this thing. We're going to be part owners. Walking through the explanation of preferred returns, definitely an education process.
Yeah. And how do you, go ahead, keep going.
No, I was just going to say, I think part of the education process, just to kind of explain to them how the process works, how we kind of add value to a property like this, and how trying to bring it down even to like a micro level of saying, imagine this was a single family home and you had your rent coming in and property taxes, expenses, and a mortgage, and then there'd be cash left over. This is just a bigger property and we're going to share in that.
Yeah. And the risk is spread around multiple units as opposed to one, right? When I got into it, I did the duplex route because I was nervous about having one single family house. And if it did rent, I'm on the hook for the whole thing. So at least it spread my risk around two units. Whereas a mobile home park, if you have a 75 spot, you have a lot of ability to kind of spread that risk around to different units. So,
For sure.
And then, so how did you get into the RV park space? Because that's similar, but different, obviously, because the rent is different and it's more of a almost like a short-term rental property than a long-term multi-year tenant scenario. So,
yeah, well, this was something I wasn't really actively looking for, but through a guy that I was good friends with, he had a park in Texas. about an hour and a half outside of San Antonio.
Okay.
That he had under contract. They had a big 1031 investor that fell out through the due diligence process. And he came to me and said, hey, we got this interesting park. It's in a town called Bandera in Texas Hill Country.
Oh, yeah.
Cowboy capital of the world. And it was an interesting park. It was a relatively newly built park by somebody that lived in town. It had some extra land, built an RV park along the river. It was mostly monthly tenants when it started, but it did have some mix of transient tenants. And the attractive part about this park was its proximity to the river and downtown Bandera, and that it had room to expand closer to the river. So we kind of said, okay, it's 57 spaces now.
Yep.
We can add some additional spaces as we get closer to the river and kind of convert it over time from being less of a monthly rental park to more of a hospitality transient rental model.
Yeah. That's interesting. I live in Austin, so I've heard of Bandera.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever been there, but yeah, I've heard of it for sure. And so when did you close on that property?
That we closed on, it was November 2022. So it's been almost a year.
I'm more in the apartment syndication world and the value add space. The typical model is you get some type of bridge loan in the beginning, and that helps to fund the renovation. And then once you kind of get it stabilized, you refinance into fixed rate long-term loan. How are the mobile home parks and how is this RV park structured? Is it similar from a lending model, or are you going to straight into fixed rate? Like, how does that work?
Well, with the mobile home parks, the Georgia parks, one I currently own in Arkansas, we had seller financing.
Oh,
so that's, again, kind of a good thing about mobile home parks in space. A lot of times you're dealing with mom and pop owners who are willing to carry back a note. Maybe they just don't want to deal with running the property anymore, but they like the income. And typically in the case of the park in Georgia, because the guy was only accepting cash in a kind of a cleanly run operation, you'd have rent rolls and bank deposits and tax returns that all kind of tie together. In this case in Georgia, they did not. The park in Arkansas, there was still a lot of cash, but it was more verifiable. But still, we approached the seller of the park in Arkansas and asked him about seller financing, and he was willing to do a 5-year interest only loan. We put, I think it kind of equated to about 28 to 30% down, and did 6% interest only for 5 years. So we said we'd do it. That was a good plan for us. So we're actually in the process right now of doing a refinance through Vanderbilt Mortgage.
So how does that work? You kind of explained a little bit, but the seller financing thing has always been super fascinating to me. I have never done or approached somebody on seller financing. Mm-hmm. So what's the benefit to the seller, right? This gentleman who's collecting cash and he has this asset, and now you're essentially going to own it, right? Like, you're taking ownership, but then you're paying, he's kind of essentially becoming the bank, right? Like,
yeah,
maybe
exactly.
Explain a little bit more, because I've looked into a little bit, but I'm definitely not an expert.
Well, it's like I said, every seller situation is different. That's where the kind of the mom and pop ownership of the mobile home park space can be interesting.
Yeah.
The parks I bought in Georgia, the guy initially said, no, I don't want to carry back a note on the property. I just want to sell it and be done with it. But through the due diligence process, we started talking to him more and we said, hey, this is really going to be hard to get bank financing, right? You haven't been reporting all your income. So you've got this huge benefit for however knows how many years. So getting a bank to loan on this is going to be really difficult. So he eventually agreed to do seller financing. And then how do you negotiate something like that? Well, it's all totally kind of open to negotiation. So he said, I have a $200,000 loan. I want a little bit of cash out. So can you give me $300,000 down on a 825 purchase? I was like, okay, that sounds reasonable to us. And then we backed into a 5.8% interest based on how much monthly income he wanted.
Got it.
So that turned out, again, turned out to be 5.8%. It got him $2,200 a month, I think it was. At the time, that was a little bit higher than market. The person we sold the park to actually assumed that note. So he assumed a 5.8% note that he's feeling pretty good about.
I'll say that's probably great if it was recent. So yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. And then from a seller standpoint, they don't have to take the capital gains. They only have to take a capital gain on the cash they receive. So if they're trying to do any kind of tax planning where they're not trying to get a big influx of cash in by selling it, they can, again, only take the capital gains on the money that they receive. And if they kind of would still like that monthly cash flow, it's a great option for them. And at worst case for them, if we default on the loan, they get to take back over a park that they've owned for years and they already know how to run. So
right.
It can be really good for them.
Yeah, I always heard the benefit to the asset owner is you kind of have your cake and eat it too, right? Because you're obviously you don't own the asset anymore, but now you're not running it, but you're just collecting cash on a monthly basis because you're running it and you're paying him a dividend by the way of an interest rate. So, and then do they typically have some type of a no refinance for a certain amount of time? Because obviously, if I'm an asset owner, I'm expecting to have some cash flow from this deal. I wouldn't want you to just go refinance it in 6 months and then I'm just collecting a big check at the end of the day.
Both of the seller finance deals I did in Georgia and Arkansas, they did not request that. And maybe if they were more sophisticated in the borrowing and lending space, they would have thought about that, but that never came up.
And you said you sold that, the mobile home park in Georgia that you had to sell. Okay, got it.
Yes, and the buyer was able to assume the note from that buyer, which again, is kind of a nice thing too. It's like told the guy we bought the park from, hey, we're going to sell it to this other guy. Do you want to go ahead and extend the note and transfer it over to this other, the new buyer? And he checked out the buyer, knew he was creditworthy, and that was okay extending it.
That's amazing. That's really fascinating. I mean, that's like the best way to do things, because to your point, you can kind of create the terms that are beneficial for you and beneficial for the seller. And if he was like, hey, I need $2,200 a month, you're like, okay, that can work into the budget, and it kind of works out for everybody.
He did this crazy thing too, where we said, actually, I think we said we wanted a 5-year interest only. And he goes, well, why don't we do a 4-year interest only? And if you want to extend another 4 years, just pay the principal down $20,000. So we're like, wow. So we essentially have a potential of 8 years interest only on this park. And only have to come up
with a $20,000 hit.
$20,000. Yeah. So there's no bank that would ever like even think about something like that.
Right. Yeah. And that's an easy, yes, please.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So how is Blue Elm Investments? Where are you at now from like a portfolio standpoint? Are you only in the mobile home and RV park space, or have you kind of expanded out into other assets?
Yeah. You know, I've expanded into other assets. My current portfolio is a park in Arkansas, my RV park in Bandera. And then earlier this year, I started working on the fund to funds model, where I was trying to look for great sponsors to work with who had in-house construction, property management, asset management, where I could partner along with them and bring different kinds of deals to my investors with much bigger operators. So I did that for a couple apartments in the Dallas-Fort Worth market earlier this year, and actually did one last year for Carolina's portfolio with another group. Yeah, so that's been actually great, because it's nice to be able to bring new deals to my investors that they wouldn't find out about otherwise. Because I'm coming in as a large LP into those deals, I can offer better terms to my investors than they would get if they just went to them directly.
Got it. And the fund of funds model, you have to be an accredited investor to invest, or how do you structure that fund of funds?
Yeah, well, with like the two Dallas deals I did this year, that operator in particular offers their deals to accredited and non-accredited. So my fund had to kind of fall in line with them. So good and bad side to that. The downside is I can't just advertise broadly about the deal. The good side to that is I did 506B to allow non-accredited investors for my first deals, like the one in Georgia, for example. And I was working with people who maybe they were making $150,000 a year as an engineer and had a $700,000-$800,000 net worth. So they were like smart, intelligent investors, and but didn't meet the sort of kind of false standards of SEC accreditation. And I wanted to give them access to these opportunities. So that's the good side about offering, having investment opportunities to open to non-accredited investors.
Yeah. The guidelines, meaning you make a certain amount of money or you have a certain net worth, just means that, yes, you've got the cushion to absorb a bad deal, but doesn't mean you're a smart enough investor to understand what you're investing in. I always was fascinated by the rules that made you accredited or non-accredited. It's a dollar. Like, are you $999,000 net worth or are you a million? And oh, now you're accredited. So,
right. You could have a brokerage statement and be like, oh, I was accredited yesterday, but oh, stock market went down 5%. So I'm not accredited anymore.
That's right. It's like by the whims of the stock market, you're either accredited or not accredited.
Yeah.
Fascinating. But, and so your kind of short, medium, long-term plan, is it to, you kind of obviously just start a new job and hopefully your boss isn't listening to this, but are you kind of trying to continue to stay in the W-2 world, or would you ultimately like to shift and have real estate be your full-time gig and raise money in your fund of funds, go out and find other deals? Like, what's that kind of look like for you?
Well, yeah, I did tell my new boss that I still had this real estate business that I'm working on. that takes less time than a fund-to-funds model, which is another reason for that transition is that when you're kind of actively operating deals, it takes a lot of time. And I still have a couple deals that I'm active in that I'd have to give attention to because those deals need it and my investors are relying on that. So I'm going to continue to do this on the side, but still kind of working on that fund-to-funds model. And that, from my standpoint, takes trying to look and talk to and meet good operators, like in good markets, in asset classes that I think would be interesting to my investors. So I'm still actively doing that now. I probably have 7 or 8 people I'm talking to kind of in a variety of asset classes, variety of markets that I hope will be interesting offerings for my investors probably early next year.
Yeah. I'm curious about kind of the asset classes that you're interested in, because obviously we're recording this in late October 2023, so still in this high interest rate environment. There's all this churn in the market with the variable rate debt, value add stuff across the different commercial asset classes. So like, where are you looking for operators to be kind of focusing in from an asset class perspective, but also from location perspective? I'm just kind of curious what that looks like for you as you think about your investors.
Yeah, well, the couple deals that I worked on in Dallas this year, the operator bought interest rate caps to be able to, which are expensive, but offer great protections for investors, knowing that you've got this limit on what your interest rate's going to be. Some of the other ones I've seen that are interesting, as long as they're in good markets where there's job growth, inward migration, are situations where people are able to assume debt. And in those situations where somebody is able to bring across 3%, 4%, 5% interest into the deal, then those can make them attractive. And then also just trying to find operators who are able to buy assets at a discount. And they're out there. You know, you got a lot of operators that bought deals back in 2019, 2020, 2020 that haven't added value the way that they had planned to. And with interest rates going up and loan to values requirements changing, they're just not able to stay in the deal. So certain situations like that, you can find apartments, for example, at 20 to 30% less than what they were trading for a year and a half ago.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Obviously, I had a property manager reach out to me that we bid on a deal and 3 years ago, and now the seller needs to sell, and they're kind of trying to sell it very quietly off market just to get a fast deal. But they're still pricing, what I'm seeing is they're still pricing it as if it's a low interest rate, low cap rate environment. And so I looked at this one, I'm like, they increased the price by, I think, $4 million. And I'm like, well, they didn't really do much. So how am I able to justify this increase in the price? I can probably buy it for what they bought it for 3 years ago, but not at an increase. So I think there's still
buyers out there that haven't come to deal with the new reality of where we're at.
Yeah, yeah. And I haven't talked to a lot of brokers recently, but I'm sure that they're also scratching their head around where do I price this, because they have to bid or say that they can get a high enough value to get the deal right from the seller to be able to list it, but then not too high that when they bring it out to investors that they don't come back with a much lower number. And then it's like, what are we doing here? So we're in a very interesting environment for sure.
Yes, for sure.
So I talked to a few people that are they're raising funds for the distress that is going on currently and that will likely continue through 24 to scoop up some of these distressed deals at a discount, whether they've gone to foreclosure or they're in a situation where the operators need to just get out and let somebody else with more capital come in and hopefully save the deal at the end of the day. So are you looking at those types of operators, or are you raising a fund for any of that kind of opportunistic acquisitions?
You know, I wasn't planning to. As I talk to operators or see a lot of deals that come across my desk, I'm sometimes looking at them through both lenses, like, oh, like, might this be something I want to bring to my investors, or might this be something that I want to invest in passively myself? Because I'm also a passive investor in quite a few syndications. So I've seen a few of those recently, and they're intriguing. I think the returns are good. I think you come in and sit in the capital stack is pretty interesting. So that may be a passive investment for me coming soon.
Got it. So what's your kind of plan for the rest of 23 and 24? Like, crystal ball, what are you kind of goals and what are you looking at?
Yeah, a couple of months ago, I thought I might be able to put together another syndication kind of exiting 2023 in addition to the two I did already. I think the RV park that we bought in Bandera last year, we closed in November. So we were kind of trying to get investors' attention leading up to that closing deadline.
Yeah.
And it's challenging, right? People are busy. Some people might be thinking about, hey, how can I kind of come in at the end of the year and make an investment to get depreciation.
Right.
A lot of other people have kind of checked out and they're just too busy with everything coming along with the holidays to really give the attention that's necessary as a passive investor to look at a deal. So I'll probably look more towards Q1 of 2024 to bring another opportunity to my investors.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, I want to transition here to the final three pack of questions that I ask every guest. So let's start out with, what's one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your real estate journey?
I think it was probably just to like take action. I think I kind of learned early on, received many examples from people in the business where people get into that analysis paralysis, where you kind of look at deals, you talk to people, and you don't actually ever do it. And while you don't want to rush into anything and make a big mistake, there is this point where you've educated yourself enough, and whether you're going to do something active and buy something directly or invest passively, that you've got to take action and do it. And that's in many cases where the real learning begins, where you learn that, like my first single family home purchases, this is what it's really like to deal with a property manager and manage them and deal with repair issues and then go through the sale process. So for me, I think it's really just educate yourself as much as you can, and then eventually you really have to take action.
Yeah, you're never going to have 100% of the information. And when you do, it's going to change, especially once you get into the real world and start operating it. So
that's fair.
What is your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
Let me see. What have I read recently? Well, you know, one I read recently was Who Not How. Mm. And it's the idea behind the book is, instead of thinking if a problem comes up or I need to get something done, instead of thinking, well, let's see, how can I do that? You really should think of who can I do to and do that for me? Because there's things that I'm good at and I like to do, and there's things that other people are good at that they like to do. So I've tried to build that in my business as much as possible, because I think my tendency, having a finance background and being very hands-on, is my first inclination to say, okay, like, how can I go in there and figure this out? But to really kind of build and grow and scale an organization or a business, one of the first things you have to think about is, okay, like, who can help me do this? Who's better at doing it than I am?
Yep. No, I read that book a few months ago, and I've got my own real estate business and I've got a recruiting business. And it's definitely an eye-opening experience when you read that book and you're like, wait a minute, I don't have to do everything. And even though, yes, it's a typically going to have to spend some money, right? Invest some money into a person or a software or something, the exponential growth that you're going to see from that investment theoretically could be really large, as opposed to you just grinding away and working an extra 5 hours a day. It's a very interesting book for sure. All right, last question here. If you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you can live an amazing life just off of the passive income from your investments, what would you do?
Let's see, I think I would probably try to travel as much as possible. I've been able to do like a lot of traveling in my life. There's still a lot of places I haven't been to. So I think I would hit the road and start doing a lot of traveling.
No, that's fair. That's fair. Awesome. This has been a great conversation, Todd. How can people reach out to you if they want to learn more about Blue Elm and some of the other deals you're working on and all that?
Yeah. Please feel free to reach out to me directly. My email is Todd, T-O-D-D, at BlueElmInvestments.com. Come check out the Blue Elm Investments website. Sign up for our investor club. I do regular updates on market updates or potential investment opportunities I have. So feel free to find me there. Also on the website, I was a co-author in a book called Success Habits of Superachievers. Mm. If you go to my website, you can download an ebook copy of that book.
Very cool. Awesome. Todd, thank you very much for being on the podcast. It was awesome to learn about you and your journey. And it was great.
Oh, fantastic. I enjoyed it. Thanks, Justin.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way, you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.